Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in the East. Today, another family of a young black man shot by police is sharing its pain with a country still reacting to Tuesday's guilty verdict of ex-cop Derek Chauvin. This afternoon in Minneapolis, the funeral for Dante Wright, 20 years old, the father of a two-year-old, shot and killed by a police officer after being pulled over for expired license plate tags. The officer claiming she meant to use her taser instead of her gun. She's now facing charges of second-degree manslaughter. The pain on display from Dante Wright's family today, palpable. No action, no progress, no breakthrough, no semblance of justice will ever return to them, their loved one. But they took the moment anyway to call for change, hoping that no more families will have to join the most painful club they now share with the families of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Eric Garner, and so many others, calling for an end to systemic racism in law enforcement. And in Dante Wright's memory, our colleague, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who delivered the eulogy, offered up a new rallying cry in this movement for change.
As I talked closer to the family, they said that, well, the real reason they stopped was because his tags had expired. Well, I come to Minnesota to tell you, your tags have expired. Your tags of racism has expired. Your tags of police brutality has expired. Your tags of white supremacy has expired. Your tags of looking at us different than everybody else has expired. Your tags have expired. It's time to renew and get some new tags. A tags of righteousness, a tags of fairness, a tags of treating everybody the same way, a tags of no justice, no peace.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar also spoke at the funeral today, taking on the Wright family's calls for action and making a promise to grieving families in this critical moment in the fight against racial injustice to champion the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act and fight against systemic racism.
Racism in this country is not isolated. It is systemic. And so when we ask ourselves why Dante Jr. has to grow up without a dad, when we think about what could possibly fill this hole Dante left in the world, we come up empty. Instead, we find a much bigger hole where justice should be. So as we remember Dante's life and grieve his death, we must repair what's broken in this country and make sure class clowns and basketball fans, doting fathers and caring sons remain with us in body, as Dante now does in spirit, Mrs. Wright. And we won't rest until justice, true justice, is done.
In fact, another day of mourning for another black American killed by police is hanging over and just might be injecting some momentum into the conversation around legislation on police reform in Congress. That's according to new reporting in the Washington Post, which adds this, quote, bipartisan talks are picking up speed as President Biden prepares to highlight the topic in his address to a joint session of Congress next week. Much of the activity is unfolding behind the scenes. The result is a sense of movement not seen since the immediate aftermath of Floyd's murder last year. Republican Senator Tim Scott, the lone black senator in the Republican Party, is spearheading the charge on the right. Axios reports this, quote, Senator Tim Scott told reporters Wednesday he plans to reintroduce his police reform bill or a similar proposal in the coming weeks and says he has discussed a potential compromise with Congresswoman Karen Bass and Senator Cory Booker. But Axios warns that previous bills passed in the wake of previous funerals have failed to materialize. Quote, after George Floyd's death last summer, Democrats, led by Bass, and Republicans, led by Scott, introduced two different bills to reform policing. There was significant momentum for action, but neither bill gained enough support to become law. And the debate largely devolved into partisan bickering. And in the wake of Donald Trump's presidency, a combined infection of disinformation runs through the GOP. An apparent fear among Republican lawmakers of alienating elements of Trump's base. Republicans who hope for compromise might find themselves up against a blockade of far-right obstruction. From the 34 states now taking up legislation that targets protesters, bills that have cropped up as the Black Lives Matter movement has gained influence, to messages like this banner on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News this week. In the wake of Chauvin's conviction, it read, "Left celebrates Chauvin verdict as proof riots work." That is what Republican Senator Tim Scott is up against on his own side as he sets out to lead the charge for police reform. And that is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. The Reverend Al Sharpton is actually here. He's the host of MSNBC's Politics Nation, the president of the National Action Network. Also joining us in a minute, MSNBC contributors Eugene Daniels, White House reporter and co-author of Politico's Playbook, Mark Gay, New York Times editorial board member, as well as our colleague, NBC News correspondent Shaquille Brewster, live for us in Minneapolis. Rev, I know you are between tragic events today. We're so grateful to have you for a few moments. First, tell us how the family is doing.
Well, obviously, this is a very trying day. We are literally in the car headed to the cemetery, and they wanted the world to know that they want to see real change. The George Floyd's family is here with us, and the mother of Philando Castile, the family of Oscar Grant, so many families that understand this pain. And we want to turn this pain into some real change, some real effort to reform policing. And it's not a partisan issue. It's an issue of what policing ought to be. I said in the eulogy, Nicole, that this is the first time we saw policemen get on the stand and testify against a fellow officer. So if policemen have began to break down the blue wall of silence, it's time for us to really use this moment to deal with federal legislation on policing like the generation before me dealt with Jim Crow laws state by state. They made it federal law with the Civil Rights Act of 64 when I was just a little boy. We need to have federal law so we don't have to go state by state dealing with police conduct.
None of these reforms will bring back George Floyd or Dante Wright. And I wonder where that strength to sort of champion for future change comes from these families.
I think that nothing will bring their loved one back and nothing will fill a hole in their heart. But I think the only thing that could give them some strength is the hope that they can use the memory of their loved ones to stop other George Floyds from happening and other Dante Wrights from happening. And then they feel that they did not suffer and die in vain. And that is why I think that they've been committed. Most of those parents that have now worked with National Action Network and I, who I'm here in the capacity of president of, is most of those that turned into activists and are still with us. 7 years ago, Eric Garner lost his life. His mother's been on the vanguard ever since, Trayvon Martin's mother. So many of the mothers, the mother of Philando Castile's here today. All of these that are here have turned into activists, and I think they find them, their strength in saying, if I'm active, I can help another family not have to go through what I went through.
Rev, this week you've been in Minneapolis with the family of George Floyd. You're now at the funeral there for Dante Wright. So I know you're not sort of in your capacity either for MSNBC or working the phones on legislation. But I wonder if this moment feels different on the legislative and policy front.
I do. Both senators from the state of Minnesota was here. I talked throughout the week with various senators like Senator Booker. And today, Mark Morial was here, the president of the National Urban League. I called for the eulogy, the president, who has met with us when he was president-elect virtually, to have a White House meeting with leaders of civil rights organizations that he committed to on that, to talk about this legislation, and the attorney general. It's time in the middle of all of this. We're dealing with a police case in Columbus, Ohio, seeing what the facts are there. We're dealing with a shooting in North Carolina. We're dealing with the killing here, Dante, while the jury was getting ready to go out on George Floyd. With all of this together, it creates a national crisis that needs to be addressed at this hour. If now is not the time, I don't know when it ever will be the time.
Reverend Al Sharpton, thank you so much on a day like today for making some time to talk to us. We're really, really grateful. And we carried your eulogy. It was powerful, as always. Thank you, my friend. Shaquille Brewster is covering. Thank you. Shaquille Brewster is on the ground in Minneapolis for us, as always, covering today's events. Shaq, take me inside. You're obviously there in a different capacity as the Rev. He's a participant. You're there covering it. Take me inside what happened there today. And it's obviously impossible to separate, as the Rev was just saying, what happened Tuesday from what happened today. Talk about just the intersection of emotion there in this one small area.
Well, what you saw there, Nicole, was part pain and part purpose as this funeral and this memorial service went on. You saw the heartbreak of the family, of Dante's mother, who was in tears every time the camera was on her, really dealing and struggling with the loss that she faces. You heard from his siblings, the six siblings he leaves behind, three brothers, three sisters. You saw his two-year-old boy that he leaves behind. So you really get a sense, and you got a heartbreaking sense of the family's pain as we watch this memorial service. But just as they were in pain, they also had a sense of purpose. And you saw that and heard that from the speakers. You heard that with the bite that you played from Reverend Al Sharpton. And as he summarized his eulogy, you heard that from Senator Amy Klobuchar, who got on stage and talked about systemic racism. You saw that from the governor of the state. I mean, when you look at the dignitaries there, that the guests that were at this memorial, you really got a sense that this was the state trying to say, hey, we understand the loss, but we want to go forward beyond this. And I think that wraps up what we saw this entire week, starting on Tuesday with the verdict, the conviction of Derek Chauvin, the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin, who is now in a state prison. We saw that yesterday with the Department of Justice launching that pattern and practice investigation against the Minneapolis Police Department. You're getting a sense that people are trying to say, what do we do next? How do we move forward from this beyond the pain and turning that into something of substance? And that's what really you got at the memorial service earlier today, Nicole.
Shaq, stay with us as part of this conversation. I want to bring Eugene and Mara into the conversation. I mean, Eugene, as a mother, I can never understand the answer the Rev gave and this description of pain and purpose, that if I lost a child, where the strength comes from to be part of change. But there is no doubt that this little sort of signs of life around legislation on Capitol Hill do not exist in a vacuum separate from these families and their ability to use their voices at the darkest moments of their lives. Can you just pull back the curtain on what is actually happening on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, to that point about, you know, being a mother in this time, me and my mother have had extensive conversations about what would have happened if she was in this position. So it's a conversation that parents are having with their kids, right? And it's hard to understand and hard to think about. These parents and families, they take on the mantle.
Well, you have to tell me what that conversation sounds like. What is that conversation?
It sounds like a lot of tears. It sounds like me and her coming to terms with what we've always talked about since I was a kid, that I am more likely than my white partner to have an issue with police officers, no matter what I'm doing. And so that is something that, you know, weighs heavily on her, weighs heavily on all the people in my family and Black families all around this country. And that is something that the leaders in this country have to get in their heads, right? That it is not just about the legislative fight. It is not about the protests. It is about these families. And, you know, when you talk about the legislation that's happening right now, you talked about Tim Scott. He is the kind of spearheader on the right hand side of things here. And he has great relationships. People really like him. Will he be able to get something like this done? The sticking points for Republicans, qualified immunity, being able to sue police officers. For him, a compromise might be being able to sue police departments, right? So there's some places there where Democrats and Republicans can find a place to agree. But there's also the militarization of police departments, getting actual military equipment to police departments, chokehold ban on no-knock warrants that Republicans and Democrats disagree on when it comes to police reform. Something that is, I guess, promising for people who really want something to get done is that this White House is very clear that they want to make sure something happens. Vice President Kamala Harris has actually helped to draft the George Floyd in Justice and Policing Act. Mm-hmm. So she has them this fight. And President Biden has talked about how important this is for him because he knows his one of his strongest constituency is the Black voter. And he has to, in his administration, have to get something done, whether that's pressing Congress to do more or having the Justice Department, like Shaq said, do these pattern or practice investigations that we didn't really mm-hmm. see under the Trump administration.
You know, Mara, just listening to Shaq's reporting and Eugene's personal and sort of scope of his reporting about what's happening on the Hill, it cannot be overstated how abrupt the change is from the last Attorney General, Bill Barr, who on television did not accept or acknowledge or appear at least publicly to believe that systemic racism was a thing. He did not see it. It's almost like the climate frame, right? He did not see it. So there was nothing that the last federal government could do over the last 4 years to address it. And I wonder, it's not a light switch. I mean, I've worked in the federal government. You don't just switch it overnight. But I wonder whether you feel optimistic now about the changes at the Justice Department, the sort of momentum and possibility. I call it signs of life on Capitol Hill because it's never over till it's over. But what do you make of this moment?
You know, it's always been an uphill battle. But there's so many reasons to be hopeful right now. I found myself in the last week thinking so many times about all those voters, especially Black voters that went to the polls and new voters and a whole coalition that went to the polls in November to elect Joe Biden. And this is proof positive that elections matter. I think it's also a really wonderful antidote to some of the cynicism that we've seen from all parts of the political spectrum in the past 4 years. It's still an uphill battle. There's no doubt about that. But I do think one of the other reasons to be hopeful is that, you know, you saw not only in the Black community in America, but, you know, in many other communities, including among white Americans, a massive outpouring, not just of sympathy for these families and for George Floyd's family, but almost of collective embarrassment, I would say, a sense of ownership of, I don't want this kind of violence to continue in my name as a citizen of the United States. And I think that coalition is the coalition, frankly, that elected Joe Biden. And that coalition extends even beyond that to Republicans, to others who really see that this is completely out of control. No other civilized nation would allow this to go on. And it's an overreach by government in the cases of so many of these police killings. So I actually think there's a whole lot of reason for hope. And I think another thing that really struck me this past week was listening to George Floyd's brothers. He has a lot of brothers, which I didn't realize, but they were so powerful the other day speaking after the verdict. And when they talked about their faith, it really felt like I was kind of in church, in a Black church specifically. And it was a great reminder of the power of hope and the power of, I think, the Black community, which has for generations, right, had to hope in the face of hopelessness. And it was such a refreshing thing as well to see the word of God and the name of God invoked, not to talk about stripping people's rights away, whether that be transgender Americans or women, but in fact, talking about justice. So as an American, as a Christian, it was really a moment of hope. And the idea now is to turn that into action and to coalition build. And it's still going to be difficult, but I'm more hopeful than I have been in a long time.
Wow. Eugene, Shaq did days, weeks, months now of brilliant reporting on the ground and on this story for us in Minneapolis, but none so much as on the day of the verdict. And Shaq, I hope I'm not embarrassing you by saying this with you here, but there was one interview with a Minneapolis resident, a white man, a young white man, who said he had Googled, how can I support Black Lives Matter? And I think there are a lot of people like that. And I wonder if you could just speak to the political power of the broad nature of support for change.
Was that me or Eugene?
Anyone of you. Eugene, you go first, and then Shaq, I'll give you the last word.
I watched that interview, and it was powerful. You know what I mean? It makes you tear up a little bit because, you know, over the last year, we've watched the protests, and, you know, all the Black people that are here right now can tell you how many conversations we've had with our white colleagues, with our white friends about what they can do. And something that you often hear from activists is that we can't always be explaining, right? Like, Black people can't always be doing the explaining. So to hear someone say, you know, I Googled it. I just Googled what can I do as a white person to help Black Lives Matter? Like, that gives you a little bit of hope because it's hard to find that when you're constantly seeing these images and constantly seeing, you know, Black people being shot by police officers. So I think what it does is it provides everyone with a little flicker, a little bit more emotional bandwidth. Because at times it's just too heavy. You talk to any Black person and the last year has just been too much. And years of that is too much and when it comes to trauma. And so it does give you a flicker of hope that because we know that change will happen when the people who are in power get that through their heads. And that includes white people on issues of race, right? So when white people really get to come to the table, really understand what Black people have been saying for generations, that is when we'll start seeing things. So it, like, you know, it does start to feel like there's a little bit of hope out there.
Shaq, last word is yours.
Very quickly, I'll say, Nicole, something that always stuck out in me since I first got to Minneapolis after George Floyd's death is how many people went to George Floyd Square, that intersection that's still closed off, just to see what was going on and specifically to talk to people who were there. You saw people not only bringing their kids, but they would try to engage with other people and just say, hey, I want to hear what's going on. What's on your mind? What are you thinking right now? And I think you have, you know, through these instances, these moments that no one asks for, no one is looking for, but you have opportunities each and every time, as the car goes by, sorry, each and every time you have these opportunities where people are engaged. They lean in a little bit harder than they did before. And I think that's what you saw the day after the verdict where, you know, one thing I would have asked him afterwards if we weren't live was, you know, why today? What was it about the verdict that made you come out and Google it today as opposed to when George Floyd first died? But you have these moments where you don't know what it is. You don't know what specific detail gets them. But that's when you see people leaning in just a little bit more and you chip away at the bigger problem.
I'm so grateful for all of you, for all your voices, for fielding my questions. Eugene Daniels, Mara Gay, and Shaquille Brewster, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. When we come back, Republicans are fighting Republicans on police reform as Tim Scott tries to play a constructive role, while some of the most prominent and loudest voices on the right are going hard on disinformation over the Chauvin verdict. And America's comeback on the world stage got a boost today from President Biden's climate agenda. This is Putin walks back his troop buildup on the border of Ukraine. We'll talk Biden reasserting American leadership. Plus, then there was just one opponent to hate crime legislation in the Senate. We'll tell you who, you might be able to guess. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit MSNBC.com/app to download.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
With the life of another young Black man killed by police here in America, mourned publicly and collectively just in the last hour, The anger and grief and momentum is apparently taking the form of some hope in the Senate for bipartisan efforts toward police reform, real reform. Legislative progress was short-lived following George Floyd's death last year. Republican Senator Tim Scott is now expressing confidence that there's, quote, more traction this year as he negotiates with Democrats, Senator Cory Booker and Congresswoman Karen Bass. But can he get his colleagues to move on this? His prominence in the party growing in just the last hour, top Republicans have asked him to speak to the nation on behalf of the Republican Party following President Biden's address to a joint session of Congress next week. Joining our conversation, Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California. She's the former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. It's a pleasure to get to talk to you today. I wonder if I could first get your thoughts on all the events of the week, and then we'll dive into what's happening up there, the verdict, and then today, another family grieving in public and calling for change.
Sure, Nicole. Thank you for having me this afternoon. This has been quite a remarkable week. It's been a defining moment, not only for the African-American community, but for the entire country as a whole. The verdict, I believe, really opened and cracked the door to accountability, police accountability. But true justice would have been that Mr. Floyd never would have been killed, and countless others. And so we have to see this as a moment. Yes, finally, there was some accountability, but we must move forward, and we must move forward in a way that will allow for true justice to prevail. And we have to get this bill passed, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The moment is now. We cannot wait. We must do it. And I'm so pleased that my colleague and friend, Congresswoman Bass, Senator Scott and Senator Booker are working day and night to get this done.
And the bill, I like to put up what's in it, actually, because I think disinformation on the right has confused people. So let me just go through some of the substance of it. It overhauls qualified immunity for police officers. It federally bans chokeholds. It prohibits no-knock warrants in federal drug cases. It outlaws racial profiling, ensures the use of body cams, creates a national registry of police misconduct, and it limits military-grade equipment going to state and local law enforcement agencies. It all sounds very rational. Can you tell us what the sticking points are?
It's all very rational. Federally to ban chokeholds? Come on. The sticking point, of course, we know there are several, but of course, qualified immunity, ending that. So we can say within the law that no one is above the law, including police officers. That should be a given. And so this is a very thoughtful bill. It's a very moderate bill. It's a bill that Republicans and Democrats, myself, I have supported it. Of course, this is the first step. And I'm so happy that the president and Vice President Harris have come out publicly and said we need to do this and we need to do it quickly. Once again, the core of this issue, of course, is structural racism in our criminal justice system and in our judicial system. But we can minimally, and what you laid out in terms of what the bill called for, I mean, come on, mandate data collection on police encounters, establish a national standard for the operation of police departments. All of these are reasonable and should have been put into law decades ago. It would have saved many, many lives.
The attack, though, on the other side really isn't even to debate the merits of whether or not police officers should be above the law or not. It really is this onslaught of disinformation. And there was a Washington Post fact check, I think, that plays into this debate, a finding that 96% of Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful with no damage or police injuries. 96.3% involved no property damage. That's the Washington Post number. Yet you've got folks on the right who are going to be influential and perhaps catastrophically destructive to Tim Scott's efforts to come to the table and deal with the substance of this. We're talking about how the riots pressured the jury. How do you combat that and give him some running room to compromise with Democrats?
Yes, and I think that, of course, the power is with the people. I think that this disinformation campaign, we know, happens each and every time. I mean, look at what they did as it relates to January 6th. Look at what Donald Trump has said over and over and over again, that President Biden did not win the elections. This is part of their tactics. This is part of their strategy. And I tell you, though, I believe the country, our young people, the young people who have been protesting with our allies throughout the country in peaceful protests will win, because this is a matter of truth. It's a matter of justice. And truth always, you know, beats out and wins over distortions and lies. But it's hard work. And we have to work with our young people, with those who are protesting, as well as with Senator Scott, and work continually in a bipartisan way. And once again, Congresswoman Bass and Senator Booker and Senator Scott are putting this together in a way that I dare people to try to misrepresent what they're trying to do. And when you look at what lies have been told, I think people are waking up to the fact that the Black community has been under siege. The stress, the anxiety, the un-American policies that have been put forth to try to keep African-Americans, Black and brown people, subjugated and marginalized and discriminated against, those days are over. And this is one step to address systemic and structural racism in our march toward justice.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, we're so grateful to get to talk to you today. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks.
Up next for us, global leaders thanking President Biden today for reasserting the United States back on the world stage after we essentially sat out the last 4 years from leading on a whole host of issues. Today included taking up greater efforts on climate change. That's next.
By maintaining those investments and putting these people to work, the United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade. That's where we're headed as a nation. And that's what we can do if we take action to build an economy that's not only more prosperous, but healthier, fairer, and cleaner for the entire planet.
A bold pledge from the president today at a climate summit convened by the United States this morning to cut carbon emissions by half in just 9 years by the year 2030. The administration bringing 40 world leaders together, not just allies, but adversaries like Russian President Vladimir Putin, at one virtual table in a show of American leadership on climate. It's nothing short of a complete reversal from the former guy who denied the science of climate change. Politico calling the summit, quote, the world's most interesting Zoom meeting. And the message that President Biden is sending to the world, according to one administration official, is, quote, the U.S. is back. Let's bring into our conversation New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker and Ben Rhodes, former deputy national security advisor to President Obama. Lucky for us, both MSNBC contributor. Ben Rhodes, you worked, I believe, on the Paris Climate Accord. It was ripped up by the last president. My question is, how much damage was done? I mean, how much does President Biden have to go back and get us out of a hole that we're in?
Well, Nicole, I think there were two issues, really. One was lost time, that time that the United States wasn't leading on climate, wasn't pushing other countries to do more on climate, was time that not only did the United States not take more decisive action, but it usually takes America pushing countries like India, pushing countries like China to move more aggressively against climate change. And they were facing no pressure from the United States over the course of the last 4 years. So the climate community would tell you that was lost time for us in terms of what we could have been doing. I think the second challenge that remains is the rest of the world saw Trump pull out of that deal, and they're going to look at America and say, we're glad you're back at the table, we're glad you're leading, but we're worried that in 4 years, a Republican could get elected and pull out again. And that's why the legislation right. that he's pursuing is so important, because if he can do that, he can show, look, we're putting $1 trillion into transitioning our economy. No matter what happens, we're on the path and we're not turning back.
Peter Baker, the New York Times reports that Trump rolled back 112 environmental rules, 30 of them related to air pollution and emissions. And they write this, Your paper writes this. What will Trump's most profound legacy be? Possibly climate damage. It's from December 2020. Greenhouse pollution accumulates in the atmosphere, so the heat-trapping gases emitted as a result of loosened regulations will remain for decades, regardless of changes in policy. Mr. Trump's rollbacks of emissions policies have come at a critical moment. Over the past 4 years, the global level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere crossed a long-feared threshold of atmospheric concentration. Now, many of the most damaging effects of climate change, including rising sea levels, deadlier storms, and more devastating heat, droughts, and wildfires, are irreversible. Anyone who works in cable news and has the privilege of sitting here when tragedies break out, I mean, historic fires, historic floods, historic tsunamis, where does this climate-denying permission structure still exist on the right?
Well, you're right about that in the sense that President Trump obviously disputed the science, didn't agree with the science. I remember just last year he was out in California during some of those wildfires. And he was being briefed by some experts on it, and he said, you know, well, I don't believe basically your conclusions, the connections to climate change that you're making for these wildfires. And it was just an article of faith for him. For years, he called it a hoax, and he has made clear he thought it was nothing but liberal alarmism, basically. A lot of Republicans agree with him. A lot of Republicans are concerned about the economic costs that this could have. Let's face it. You know, one scenario under a 50% cut that President Biden outlined today would force basically the elimination of all the remaining coal plants in this country. If that happens, obviously, that's an impact on a lot of communities. What President Biden is trying to do is convince people that there are offsetting advantages to it, not just to in terms of the climate, but economically. That yes, we're going to lose some industries in some ways, but they're going to build new ones that will provide jobs and provide economic stimulus. And that's a sell he's going to have a hard time making to those on the right. But as Ben says, if he gets this legislation through Congress, it'll make it a more lasting change. The problem we've seen in recent years is the fact that presidents like President Obama, Ben's president, had to rely and chose to rely on executive action, couldn't get something through the Senate in terms of a treaty that would bind the country beyond his 4 or 8 years in office. Trump did the same thing by reversing it. Now we're going back. And Ben is correct that a lot of countries out there are saying, well, where are you guys going to be in 4 years? We don't know. Because you haven't gotten Congress to buy in, there's not a sustained commitment to a U.S. policy that goes beyond a single presidency.
So, Ben, if you want to pick up and respond to anything Peter said, make that part one. And make part two what this White House is looking at, in your estimation, from Vladimir Putin. He was part of this climate summit today. There's a bit of a retreat on the border, some of those troops leaving the Ukrainian border, which was seen as perhaps a test, perhaps an escalation. I believe President Zelensky told his nation to be prepared for the possibility of war. He's facing extreme pressure internationally around the treatment of Alexei Navalny. Where do you assess, where do you think this White House is in assessing Vladimir Putin today?
Well, first, I do want to say Peter's correct in the sense that not only you have regulations that can be undone on climate, but with the conservative Supreme Court, you're even more worried about even democratic regulations not surviving the courts. And that's why climate action through legislation is so important. I think on Putin and Nicole, you know, what's very interesting is right now you have very tense U.S.-Russian relations with the situation in Ukraine, with obviously the health of Alexei Navalny, with the sanctions that this administration put in place that I think were absolutely the right call. But the reality is, throughout U.S.-Russian history, throughout U.S.-Soviet history, we've had moments of extreme tension where we were still able to do things together on issues like arms control, for instance. And I think right now, you have a Biden administration that is being very confrontational, correctly, on a whole host of issues related to Vladimir Putin's conduct. But at the same time, on an issue like climate change, or on an issue like the Iran nuclear deal, where Russia's at the table in Vienna right now with American negotiators, they're able to participate in a cooperative multilateral effort like that. I think on climate, Nicole, I'd also underscore China's at the table. At a time when we saw very, pardon the pun, frosty relations between the U.S. and China, climate change is an issue that, you know, talking to the Biden people, they believe that no matter how tough the relationship gets in other spaces, we need to work with China to deal with this. So climate is one of those issues where you put aside some of the other differences you have and you work together as an international community because everybody has something at stake.
Peter, again, I got two for you. I mean, it is a return to this sort of multilateralism that has at least loosely defined American diplomacy. But more importantly, I'm looking for your insights as someone who knows a whole lot about Russia and Vladimir Putin. What do you make of his moves of late, just in the last 24 hours?
Well, look, you've got two things going on there. You've got the domestic problems at home with thousands of Russians in the streets because of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, who has been imprisoned and is near death because of a hunger strike and the lack of medical care. And then you've got this saber rattling on the border, 100,000 troops, more or less, up near Ukraine. These are not unrelated things, right? Every time the president, Putin, gets in trouble at home, he tends to play the nationalist card. He tends to look for an external threat. Either he blames internal dissent on the West. He says it's our fault people are in the streets. It's some sort of a CIA provocation. Or he uses the, you know, sort of patriotic card to say, hey, you know, we should all be together against our common enemy. And we see these Ukrainians across the border here. That's one area where we can make a difference. So these are not unrelated. But you're right. Today, he did take two actions that seem to pull back from both. One, they say they're pulling the troops back starting May 1st. It was just an exercise, and they've made their point. And two, it does seem like they have allowed some serious medical examination of Navalny at this point and are passing information along to his doctors for possibly a course of treatment. If they can reverse that and Navalny stays alive, that will obviously change the situation drastically internally. So we're seeing some pullback in the last 24, 48 hours.
We will stay on it. Peter Baker, Ben Rhodes, thank you both so much for spending some time with us today. Up next for us, following a year of amped up rhetoric from the former president that led to a rise in anti-Asian hate crimes, Congress passes today legislation aimed at combating some of that. But is it enough? We'll talk about that next.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
People are so scared right now. They're telling their parents and grandparents not to go outside to the supermarket to get coffee. They're telling their kids not to play outdoors, even if it's nice outside. I was really excited to see that there were bipartisan efforts in advancing this bill in the Senate last week. And so I'm hopeful, and I'm hearing that it will get final passage today. And I really think it sends a very strong signal to the country and to the Asian American community that discrimination against Asians will not be tolerated.
That was Congresswoman Grace Meng earlier on this network with our colleague Hallie Jackson speaking about the Senate's anti-Asian American hate crimes bill. It passed this afternoon in a vote of 94-1. Senator Josh Hawley was the one and only no vote. The bill, which garnered bipartisan support after some GOP amendments and President Biden pushing it as a priority for him, will require the Justice Department to designate an official to review coronavirus-related hate crimes, as well as strengthening the reporting of those incidents. Joining our conversation, Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu of California. Congressman, I'm tempted to start with how could Josh Hawley vote against it, but I'll just leave that for everyone's imagination unless you have any thoughts there. Is this bill, is it both policy shifts and sort of a statement that the country is united in defending and protecting and strengthening protections for the Asian American community?
Thank you, Nicole, for your question. So I'm not going to pretend to understand how Senator Hawley thinks. In terms of the policy shift, I think it is important to have the Department of Justice really focus their efforts on COVID-19 related hate crimes. We saw a stunning spike in hate crimes against Asian Americans last year of nearly 150% across major cities at a time when overall hate crimes were decreasing. And this legislation is bipartisan. I'm on a House Judiciary Committee. I'm sure that the committee and also our entire House of Representatives will support this legislation as well. And I do commend Congresswoman Meng and Senator Hirono and many others who worked on this legislation.
Let me show you something Senator Schumer said today, placing the blame for some of that uptick squarely on the shoulders of Donald Trump. Let's watch.
Now, we've made great strides since those days, but over the past several years, the forces of hate and bigotry seem to have gained strength, too often encouraged by our former president. It's time for all of us to stand up. By passing this bill, the Senate makes it very clear that hate and discrimination against any group has no place in America. Bigotry against one is bigotry against all.
So I guess my question is, and I remember Mike Pompeo, his Secretary of State, also called it the China flu, even as an ex-president, Donald Trump, in interviews has called it the China flu. I believe at one point people on the right had even more derogatory names. And we cover the rancor in our politics and the taint from him as though it happens separate from people's lives. But when you look at the statistics, a third of all Asian Americans live in fear. How do you undo the damage that he did?
So it was not helpful that the former president used racist phrases like Kung Flu. And what China did with regards to the coronavirus at the beginning was not acceptable. They misled the world. They suppressed evidence about the virus. At the same time, when you use an ethnic identifier in describing this virus, then some people in America will misinterpret it and then start causing harm against Asian Americans. And so I urge everyone to simply not use an ethnic identifier in describing this virus because you're increasing risk of hatred towards the Asian American community.
What has it been like, just sort of professionally and personally, to both sort of be an elected official as you watch this surge and growing tide of hate crimes targeting Asian Americans in this country, and to see the change of a president who sees it that way and is intent on being part of the solution in President Biden?
So what gives you hope is not only did you have the President of the United States give a primetime speech where he talked about the Asian American community. He also issued an executive order to combat hate crimes against Asian Americans. And then Vice President Harris and President Biden visited with Asian American leaders in Georgia. And in the last few weeks, we've seen a number of rallies across America in support of the Asian American community. These rallies were not massive, but they weren't small either. And so we're seeing, I believe, the political awakening of the Asian American community and a recognition that it doesn't matter what income level you're in or what job you hold or where you live, you or your parents or your child could be the victim of a hate crime.
Congressman Ted Lieu, thank you so much for spending some time with us to talk about these developments. We're grateful. For us, the next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
Empty seats can't cheer. They don't tailgate, and they don't know fight songs. Empty seats don't sing during seventh inning stretches. And they don't know stats or superstitions. There's a soundtrack for places like this, and it isn't made in a studio. It's made by you. So when it's your turn to get the vaccine, be a fan. Take the shot.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in the East. Country music superstar Brad Paisley, who will be our guest later in the hour, is lending his voice to the now frantic effort to vaccinate enough Americans to reach a level of immunity that would protect the country and those who aren't eligible for vaccines yet, people like our children, at a moment when the national vaccine effort has just started to slow. The White House today grappling with the good news and the bad news on its aggressive push to vaccinate enough Americans ahead of the spread of those dangerous variants. 200 million shots have been given ahead of President Biden's goal of doing so in his first 100 days. Half of the population receiving at least one shot. Those milestones reached as the supply of vaccines starts to outpace the demand. NBC News reporting, quote, the president has to start making a dent in the 15 to 20% of Americans who are resistant or hesitant to being vaccinated. It's according to public polling. Axios puts an even finer point on the challenge facing the Biden administration with the next 50% of the American public. Quote, the U.S. will probably run out of adults who are enthusiastic about getting vaccinated within the next 2 to 4 weeks. That's according to KFF analysis published yesterday. Quote, it appears we are quite close to the tipping point where demand for, rather than supply of vaccines, is outpacing is our primary challenge, the authors write. Federal, state, and local officials in the private sector will face the challenge of having to figure out how to increase willingness to get vaccinated among those still on the fence and identify among the one-fifth of adults who have consistently said they would not get vaccinated or would do so only if required. Enter President Biden's proposal yesterday to incentivize small businesses to have their employees get vaccinated, offering a tax credit that will reimburse them for any vaccine-related paid time off they provide, as well as organizing the help of super influencers from the world of sports, entertainment, and country music. The race against vaccine hesitancy is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Dr. Peter Hotez is here, co-director of the Texas Children's Center for Vaccine Development and founder of the dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College is here. Also joining us, David Plouffe, former Obama campaign manager, and Phil Rucker, Washington Post senior Washington correspondent. I want to ask you, David Plouffe, while I take some water to clear the frog in my throat, what a national campaign looks like that isn't anymore just about the logistics of plussing up supply, which I think the Biden administration can check off their list. They did that, of procuring and sort of really ironing out the defects in the supply chain and accessibility to pharmacies, and now pivoting to a very different effort, which involves something that you've spent your life doing, changing opinions, persuading people to do something that in these pockets they may not want to do.
Well, it's such an important question, Nicole, for the country. So the Biden administration and all of us, you know, should take credit for the vaccination numbers where they are today. Hard to believe that we're already at, particularly everyone who's gotten one dose, most of those, according to data, will get two. So half the country has been vaccinated. But I think this is really all the data I've seen in my life in politics and outside of politics suggests the most important conversation to persuade something to do something they might not do is to have a friend or family member. So I think it's really good to see the White House and the media. I think everybody needs to be realistic. We can celebrate where we are, but there's a long way to go. It's going to be really hard. There's a lot of people that are hesitant because what you want is friends and family members and coworkers and neighbors to be talking to people and encouraging them and saying, I got it. It was fine. I'm happy I got it. The other thing I think what you're going to see is more colleges and more employers, more entities in the private sector, sporting venues saying you need to be vaccinated. So there's different carrots and sticks here. But the most important thing, I think, Nicole, is to be realistic about the challenge. Now, getting celebrities out there is super important. Voices people trust is super important. But the thing people trust most is people in their own lives. And I think if we raise the stakes of what will happen if we don't reach herd immunity, that will get more American citizens to kind of be banging on their neighbors and banging on their family members to say, you need to get vaccinated if you haven't.
And Phil Rucker, this White House is very clear-eyed about what David Plouffe just articulated, that the sort of government and the public officials and the trusted doctors who are generous enough to share their time on our airwaves may at some point become less persuasive than family members and other spheres of influence. And I just want to read you some notes of what the White House announced today. Over at HHS, they're launching the We Can Do This live series to pair medical experts with prominent influencers. Some of the groups participating include Kelly Ripa, Eva Longoria, Mark Cuban, Walter Kim, the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, a lot of resistance in some of those communities, NASCAR, the NBA, the Recording Academy, and the WNBA. Talk about sort of the vastness of this campaign and the hopes for what it can achieve.
Yeah, Nicole, the Biden White House is very clearly trying to take the political sheen off of this campaign. They don't want people like Jen Psaki or Ron Klain or the president or the vice president leading this campaign. They want it to be people who don't seem to have a political agenda. Folks like David was just saying, out in the community and friends and family, but also celebrities who are not a part of our daily political conversation. And the other thing interesting that we're seeing Biden officials talk about is a focus on tone. They don't want to create an impression that they're belittling people who are hesitant to take the vaccine or making them feel stupid for not wanting to take the vaccine. Rather, they want health officials to be open and sympathetic to the concerns that people out there might have about the vaccine, to be ready to answer questions no matter what they are, no matter how silly they might seem to the experts, but to not make people feel bad about having those concerns and then try to meet them in the middle somehow to persuade them to switch sides. They realize they're not going to get to everybody, but they need to try to get to 85 or 90% of the country in order to reach that level of herd immunity that the experts believe is necessary to start turning the page on this pandemic.
Dr. Hotez, I want to read first from your new piece that touches some of this, but you're sort of the tip of the spear in going into some of these hesitant voting blocks. So I want to get your personal reflections on that effort as well. But I want to read from your new piece in the Daily Beast first. Ultimately, we must find a way to de-link anti-vaccine defiance and political allegiance to the GOP. And as a medical expert rather than a political scientist, I don't claim to know all the answers here. But we know that the impact of advocacy and reaching out can be profound. For example, vaccine refusal and hesitancy was also high in Black and brown communities across the country, but this has declined significantly, according to some polls. Talk about how that model can be used on what is really a broader swath and maybe not one we would have predicted on the right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Nicole. And as pointed out, the bar is really high. We showed early on that we need about 75% of the population to be vaccinated in order to slow transmission. That was before the B.1.1.7 variant. And the more transmissible the virus is, the higher percentage you need to vaccinate. So we do have to get to 80, 85% of the U.S. population. That's all, just about all of the adults and adolescents. So the bar is going to be high, and we're going to have an incredible quality of life once we get there. And then the question is, how do we identify these groups? And last year, we did some studies and others did as well that identified two groups, what were called Republicans / Trump voters. That was the number one group. And number two were Black and brown communities, the African-American community especially. So a number of us went on talk radio shows, podcasts that reached both groups. And we've been more successful with the African-American community. And it was interesting. I was on a podcast, not a podcast, but a Zoom call with a church group in Richmond, Virginia. I was invited by a pediatrician who belonged to the church, and they had the pastor on. And before I was talking to the pastor, I said, you know, the polls are saying that African vaccine hesitancy in the African American community is getting better. Is that your sense as well? And he said, absolutely. Things are definitely improving, though we still have some issues, but it's improving. I said, well, what did you attribute it to? And he said, well, part of it are docs like you reaching out. But he offered the other piece was as a pastor of a Black church, they'd created an informal network of clergy that had decided they weren't going to allow this, that they made a concerted effort to really bring down those vaccine hesitancy rates. And it's, I think it's working. It's going really well. Now the question is, we've got 40% of Republicans. So 25% of the U.S. population is of the adults are Republicans, according to most surveys. And of those, 40% are vaccine or going to refuse vaccines. And those are about four or five different polls from university polls and other groups. So it's pretty consistent, different methods, all same results. So how do we chip away at this? And this is going to be, I think, one of our really daunting problems of how we can reach those groups. So clearly reaching across the aisle is important. I've been going on conservative news outlets and podcasts whenever possible, but it's tough. You know, there are a lot of issues, a lot of barriers, and this business of defining their political allegiance to the Republican Party by going up against masks and social distancing and now vaccines. We've got to de-link this somehow. And unfortunately, our friends and the evening anchors at Fox News are not helping with this by going on anti-vaccine rants the last couple of weeks and targeting me and other scientists, which is what they've been doing. So trying to reach that, I think, is going to be a really daunting prospect. But we have no choice, Nicole. We have to make this work. So I'm prepared to do whatever I can to make that happen. And I'm sure the Biden administration is as well.
Now, look, it's nothing short of heroic what you do. And I say that this is one of the skeletons in my closet, but I spent much of my career crafting messages for Republicans. And I wonder, Dr. Hotez, if there's some messaging around transmission, you know, be a man, don't spread it. I mean, is there some message, if you can't convince people to protect themselves, could you convince them to protect their families and the more vulnerable people in their communities?
Well, it seems to be more resistance among men than women, and especially right. You know, a lot of young, healthy, vigorous men who say they don't need the vaccine. And a lot of that is coming out of messages, out of podcasters and various groups. And I say to them, look, this B.1.1.7 variant is not your father's COVID-19. It's more transmissible, and we're seeing lots of young people go into the hospital. And yes, it's great that you're keeping yourself in shape and physically fit. I think that's terrific, but that's not the same as virus neutralizing antibodies that will actually prevent you from getting long haul COVID, which is occurring in about 30%. So that's the kind of thing I'm trying to do. The other thing that's really interesting, when I have gone on a few of these conservative news outlets, they go right to the mandates. That there's this obsession that around vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, that's, you know, the National Guard's going to hold people down and inject them with COVID vaccine. I said, look, right now we don't even have enough COVID vaccine to do those kind of mandates. I say no one's, and they're kind of what they're doing on places at times. Is they actually create this as a straw man, as kind of a tribal call. Better watch out, the mandates are coming. And they were the first to really bring this up before anybody else did. So there's a certain tribal element to this, as far as I can see. And as I say, what do I know? I'm not a political scientist. This is just from my observations that I've been seeing. So I think trying to diffuse that mandate concept, and I say, look, right now, there's only two places where I see a place for mandates. One is the colleges, right? When my youngest son went off to college, and I point out that he studied petroleum engineer and he's works in the oil and gas industry, and that automatically gets people listening. And I say, look, when he went off to college, he had to get his meningococcal vaccinations because that's what you do when you're in the dorms, and because it spreads to all the other kids. So I could see that all the colleges mandating that works. And they sort of get that. And then I say the other place are hospitals. Nobody wants to go into a hospital knowing that the person taking care of you could be shedding COVID-19 virus, shedding the SARS coronavirus type 2. So chipping away at that and trying to work, but it's tough because now there are people who have this invested interest in showing defiance and evidence of defiance, and that one is going to be difficult. And I think courting Republican champions and reaching out to certain people, I think, is going to help a lot.
You know, David Plouffe, there's something sort of twisted about what snowflakes Republicans are, making up fake mandates for fake, you know, requirements for a vaccine that would not only likely save their lives, but could potentially stop them from spreading it and hurting somebody else. I mean, it speaks to just the deterioration of any adherence to facts and the continued harm that's been done by this sort of culture of lies.
Well, you know, the other piece to this,
let me bring David Plouffe back in. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt, Nicole. There's also the hypocrisy. These Fox News personalities, the Republican politicians, they've all been vaccinated, right? So it's kind of historical hypocrisy. But, you know, you and I have both been part of campaigns or other efforts where you're really trying to deliver a message to tough audiences. And, you know, sometimes it's mostly message, sometimes it's messengers, it's generally a blend. I think with this last holdout group, it is going to be messengers. It's going to be, as I said, people mm-hmm. in their towns, friends, neighbors, pastors, but also I think people who say, I think this is what you want to lift up, people who were vaccine hesitant, who they might have gotten COVID or their family member gotten COVID and said, this is the thing that pushed me over the edge. I mean, you can even be a little more diabolical, right? Which is, do they want to live in a country where the only people getting COVID are Trump voters. Doesn't sound so great. And so I think the messengers here are going to be absolutely essential. And I agree, there's not going to be mandates outside of colleges. Obviously, private sector companies can make their own decisions about their practices, but also raising the stakes, which is we're never going to escape this if we plateau at 70%. We've got to get to that last 80 or 85. And here's the other thing I'd say, Nicole. This is a group of people that you generally know how to reach them, okay? They are consumers of news. They watch Fox. They're Breitbart. They're in Facebook groups. Like, so they're not hiding out. So that's also useful. It's these people can be reached. The question is, will they be receptive? And again, I think we should be super creative about messages. But I think the messengers here are going to be more important than the message.
David Plouffe, Dr. Peter Hotez, thank you so much for starting us off with this conversation. Phil Rucker is sticking around. When we return, the right-wing disinformation campaign around the Capitol riot is turning Republicans against one of their own and sparking an increase in threats against all lawmakers. That's next. Plus, the fight for racial justice after the Chauvin guilty verdict. There's renewed hope for real change, but it's running up against the GOP's newest war against some of the First Amendment protections. And later, country superstar Brad Paisley joins the conversation. He's the star of that new public service announcement we played at the top of the show, urging everyone to take the shot. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Our mission, however, has become more difficult. In the first 4 months of this year, we've had a 65% increase in threats against members compared to 2020. From 2017 to 2020, there was a 119% increase in the total threats and directions of interest against members, with the majority of the suspects residing outside of the NCR. As the nation well knows, the Capitol complex is also a target.
Acting Capitol Police Chief Yogananda Pittman with an alarming report there to the Senate. Threats against members of Congress have more than doubled since 2017, and they have soared in the first 4 months of this year. More than 100 days after January 6th and the fallout from the deadly Capitol insurrection, and the big lie perpetrated by Donald Trump and his allies is reverberating absolutely everywhere, not just and the need to protect members of Congress and the Capitol complex itself, but within a Republican Party at odds with itself, still, over Trump and the big lie of a stolen election. New York Times out with a blockbuster piece detailing the rift between MAGA Republicans and one Liz Cheney, the third highest ranking member of the House GOP, who voted to impeach Trump over his role in the insurrection. Cheney refusing to back down from that vote and her comments about Trump. And at a closed door meeting about her position in leadership back in February, she said, quote, "We cannot become the party of QAnon. We cannot become the party of Holocaust denial. We cannot become the party of white supremacy." We all watched in horror what happened on January 6th. Pro-Trump House Republicans aired their grievances with Cheney. More from that Times report. Ralph Norman of South Carolina expressed disappointment in her vote, saying, quote, "But the other thing that bothers me, Liz, is your attitude. You've got a defiant attitude." Oh, my God. John Rutherford of Florida, former sheriff, accused the chairwoman of not being a, quote, "team player." Joining our conversation is former Republican Congressman Denver Riggleman of Virginia, who we're so happy to have back. Phil Rucker still here. Congressman, what's so amazing when you read investigative reporting is that it's so much worse than even the horrible picture we think of when we think of today's Republican Party. And I don't know if anyone other than Liz Cheney could be the one-woman army against the MAGA GOP.
You know, first, there's just the data is there to say that Stop the Steal or election integrity is still the number one issue in Republican circles by 25 to 30 points. Here in Virginia, you just saw Mike Flynn endorse one of the top gubernatorial candidates here, Amanda Chase, and that's going to help her a lot as she goes forward. And when you're talking about Liz Cheney, you know, I don't know if you know this, Nicole, but I was a bouncer. I know that's hard to believe now, but I was a bouncer back in the day. And I'm going to make a comparison here. You usually identify somebody in that environment, the guy or the gal who's going to sit next to you in a bar fight. Liz Cheney's going to be there whether the odds look bad or they look good, right? She's going to be the one next to you in a bar fight. I like defiant. I like somebody who thinks truth and facts are the things you need to stand on. And I think if you're in that bar fight, looking at the type of people that you have, I think Liz would be shoulder to shoulder with me when I was trying to get a bad person out of there. I think the people like Matt Gaetz are going to look for the nearest spring breakers and go hide behind them. That's the difference. I'll take Liz Cheney in a bar fight any day, and you can have the Matt Gaetz's, you can have all those individuals. And if you have people in Congress saying she's defiant or saying, you know, oh my goodness, she wasn't humble enough. The issue is that you had a lot of wrong people that were standing on sort of the shoulders of stupidity when it came to Stop the Steal. And I think it's ridiculous you have individuals that saying she's defiant when she's talking about protecting the Constitution. And again, I'll take defiant, you know, over bootlickers any day.
Well, and Phil Rucker, it's so upside down and backwards. And I was on this call with John Bolton talking about how Trump is losing his grip on the GOP. He's underwater with independents by 20 points to Joe Biden. If the election were held today, he'd probably lose by even more. But the subservience and the adherence to the lies and the slavishness and the attacks on Liz Cheney seem to be intensifying. What's behind that?
Nicole, it's really remarkable. And, you know, that piece in the New York Times by Robert Draper, a fantastic read, it paints this picture of how even after Donald Trump left office, he's no longer the president, the Republican Party remains the party of Trump, and not just the party of Trump, but it's built almost entirely around his personal following. There's virtually no difference between Liz Cheney's views on the issues, her ideology, than the other Republicans in Congress. And yet they're at war with her simply because she chose not to believe Donald Trump's lies. And it shows you that even with him out of office, he is the beating heart of the Republican Party. And he may be unpopular with independents. He probably would lose to Biden again, as you just said, as the polling would indicate. And yet almost all of those House Republicans are in lockstep with him. They've been flocking down to Mar-a-Lago the last couple of months to kiss the ring, to hold fundraisers with Donald Trump. And they're going to try to keep at it with Liz Cheney simply because Trump wants them to.
It's so weak, but I'm sure that is the right picture that Phil Rucker is painting, Congressman. And I wonder, you know, former President Bush is out with a book with paintings of immigrants talking about sort of reluctantly reengaging around the immigration debate, calls out his former or his party, still a registered Republican, as isolationist, protectionist and nativist. John Boehner is unsparing. But I wonder if it needs to be more organized. I mean, is there still a fight to be had for the soul of the Republican Party? From where I sit, it looks like it's been had and we lost the ones who were pro-soul.
I think so. I mean, I've had a difficult time identifying as a Republican here in Virginia specifically. And you know some of the story, Nicole. I mean, when you talk about conspiracy theories, you know the things that happened to me where I was accused of being funded by George Soros to change the sexual orientation of children, you know, after I had, you know, officiated a same-sex wedding. And that's when it started for me, seeing the QAnon or the conspiracy theory sort of overrun that was happening in the Republican Party. And I think we have some confusion out there with some of the GOPers. I think they're confused between what service means and what subservience means. And I always find it amazing that individuals that are representing a district would rather identify with an individual than their constituents. But there's a problem here, Nicole, and I think you mentioned it. Did we already lose the war, right? If you're talking about polling that looks at individuals in the Republican Party at the grassroots level who believes maybe 50, 60, 70% the election was still stolen. And if these individuals are more worried about being elected than the truth, we can take morality out of it. You can take integrity out of it. If they want to get elected, they got to roll with what the Republican committees are saying and what the GOP constituents are saying. And that's what scares me, is that the disinformation is so pervasive. It's very difficult for people like me and people trying to say, listen, please come back to the light here. Please come out of the rabbit hole. Because what's happening is you have grifters just taking your money and leading you down a wrong path. And I hope that we can get our arms around it. But right now, it doesn't look that great, I think, for the GOP right now when it comes to those type of individuals.
Yeah. And I guess, Phil Rucker, what's so remarkable is after January 6th, it's clear that there is an extremism problem. And it doesn't have its roots in Antifa on the left. When it comes to violence perpetuated against the government, at least on January 6th, it all came from people waving Trump flags. So you tell me where it's coming from. Is there anyone who privately has concerns about security, national security, homeland security, and extremism in their own ranks?
Oh, sure. a lot of Republican leaders do have those concerns, but they're afraid to talk about them publicly because of Trump, because they don't want to be excommunicated from their own party. The way Liz Cheney and others have been. They don't want to become the next Mitt Romney, for example, there are a lonely few who've been willing to speak publicly about the real dangers here, not only the subservience to Trump, but the dangers in terms of these conspiracies, the dangers in this democracy and believing that an election was rigged when the evidence show it wasn't rigged, the dangers to the Capitol on January 6th, but also these threats to the lives of these lawmakers. So few of them have the political capital and independence and frankly, the guts, the courage to speak the truth that they believe. But our reporting shows, and you know it too, Nicole, that many more of them believe this privately. They just won't say so.
And it's just pathetic that they call themselves leaders, you know, private fears about true dangers from extremism in their own party, and they won't do anything. Unbelievable. Denver Riggleman, it's a pleasure to have you back, my friend. Thank you. And Phil Rucker, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you both. When we return, after the Chauvin guilty verdict, Republicans are now going on the attack against the First Amendment itself. That story's next. Following Tuesday's trial verdict, accountability for the murder of George Floyd, the white former police officer, guilty on all three charges. Democrats negotiating with Republican Senator Tim Scott on the police reform bill they named after George Floyd argue that the verdict cannot be a substitute for real legislation and reform. For The New Yorker, Jelani Cobb, who was outside the Minneapolis courthouse on Tuesday, reflects on the reality of what the verdict and this week mean on a larger scale, saying, quote, "It's important to remember that nothing that happened today changes the fact that we were witness to a man losing his life in the most excruciating way while constantly saying he couldn't breathe and begging for intercession from his dead mother. Some things you will never get out of your mind. Rather than say of the verdict that this is the best case scenario, I'd prefer to say that it's the least worst case scenario." Let's bring into our conversation Jelani Cobb, staff writer for The New Yorker and Columbia Journalism School professor, who attended Dante Wright's funeral today. Also joining us, New York University law professor and MSNBC contributor Melissa Murray. Jelani, let me start with you first. You're there. Tell us about today and about your comments about Tuesday, quite a week.
Yeah, so I'm in George Floyd Square now. I'm in the area where he died last May. But earlier, just an hour or so ago, I was at the funeral for Dante Wright, which was really, it was kind of a whiplash, you know, because there was a great deal of relief and, you know, joy, jubilation, really, at the guilty verdict that came down in the Derek Chauvin trial. And then just that quickly, people were kind of whipsawed back into this grieving mode, and the kind of very moving ceremony that was held, and you know, a trumpeter did a solo while an artist painted a portrait of him, and the family members of other people who've lost, who've been killed in police violence were there. Philando Castile's mother was there. Breonna Taylor's boyfriend was there. There were the Floyd family, significant representation from the Floyd family. Descendants, or rather relatives of Emmett Till were there. And so it really just was a difficult thing, even as someone who has covered many of these stories, it was a very difficult thing to kind of witness that outpouring of community grief.
Do you feel, I don't want to use optimistic, but do you feel different? Do you feel like the ground underneath the debate about policy changes has shifted at all because of the community, because of the attention in the wake of Tuesday?
Well, I will say this. I think that people feel like they have momentum. You know, and it was hard to see that, to not think that from the funeral. The governor, Tim Walz, was there. Senator Amy Klobuchar was there. The attorney general, Keith Ellison, was there. And you know, representatives of national civil rights organizations were there. And they were all on one note talking about the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act and saying that that has to become law. And so if there's anything such as kind of having the wind at their back on this issue, then I would say that now is a moment where that's the case. And people here, even in the midst of the verdict, would say that they were cautiously optimistic. They felt like they've gotten a victory, but it's just one victory in a long road and that there's a lot of work to be done.
Melissa, When I saw the Attorney General, the current Attorney General Merrick Garland, addressing the policy changes at DOJ, and you read some of the, I think cautiously optimistic is the right word, cautiously optimistic reporting about the legislative process, you know, it's just important to remind people that the George Floyd Policing Act really is not a radical piece of legislation. It has a lot of things in it that have a lot of public support. And I wonder what you think, both from a legal perspective and a policy perspective, about the importance of just getting that through and starting here.
Like, I think Jelani really hit the nail on the head. The verdict was certainly a catalyst for change, but a lot is going to have to happen in the policy realm. And that needs to happen at both the federal level and the state and local level. And the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is certainly one step. But there are many questions about getting this resolved and through the Senate. There are a lot of questions on both sides of the aisle about whether they can come to some kind of reconciliation on questions of qualified immunity. There's considerable discussion of whether chokeholds will continue to be included in the bill as something that is prohibited or whether that will be taken out. And it's unclear whether activists on the ground will find the ultimate bill that, if it gets passed, is actually satisfying for the reforms that they want. But most importantly, it's worth noting that that policing is quintessentially a local and state-level enterprise. Sure. The federal government can certainly encourage states and localities to do better, but ultimately a lot of the policy reform efforts have to come at the local level.
Melissa, can you speak to this whiplash, which is the perfect word for it, week that Jelani describes, the verdict Tuesday, and another tragic public sharing of a family's grief?
Well, I think it made very clear that the verdict on Tuesday was a respite, but it is not a reprieve, that there are larger questions about policing, about the propriety of certain protocols, and whether, in fact, public safety is actually served by the kind of policing that we currently have in the United States. And these are bigger questions that are not going to be resolved by any single piece of litigation in the courts, but really, again, will be reformed if they're going to be reformed at the policy level and at the grassroots level.
You know, Jelani, we have covered the voter suppression laws that, you know, it certainly gets our attention when the rare Republican will say, oh, you know, these are all built on a lie. And now there's new reporting in the New York Times this week about the attacks on the rights to assemble. I think 34 states are looking at bills to clamp down on protests. The Black Lives Matter protests were, Washington Post analysis has them at 96.3% peaceful. Another one has them at 97.3% peaceful. How do you combat Republican legislating based on lies?
I mean, I think that's the question. And certainly, you know, we as media have an obligation here to keep telling the story and to keep pointing out inconsistencies here and to keep revealing the canard of there being problems with the integrity of our ballots. And so there's been a very successful disinformation and misinformation campaign around these things. But I'll also say that these things are not unrelated. You know, the fact that we can see people have the temerity to pass laws banning public assembly when they did virtually nothing in the face of what happened on January 6th. And that is in itself just kind of highlights the hypocrisy and contradictions that we're looking at here. And one last thing to Melissa's point, this is absolutely a local issue. This is not going to be solved on the federal level. There are 18,000 police departments in this country, and the federal government couldn't provide oversight for all of them if they wanted to. And so this is going to quintessentially be a local issue. It has to be one in each small locale and in small community.
Jelani Cobb and Melissa Murray, thank you both for spending some time with us today. I'm really grateful to get to talk to both of you. Thank you. When we return, that man on your screen right now will be our next guest, country music superstar Brad Paisley, part of the effort to reach out to those who haven't yet been vaccinated. He'll join us after a short break. Don't go anywhere. When he marked the one-year anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic, President Biden named the 4th of July as our target, a target for our country to return to normalcy, a time that Americans could potentially gather with friends and family to celebrate an independence from the virus. It's a goal, he says, is within reach if the country keeps up the fight maintaining its current level of vaccinations. It's an effort that's getting support from voices outside the political sphere, including country superstar Brad Paisley, who's out with this message. Watch.
We want your cheers. We want you in the upper decks and in the front row. We want you to see us break records and break ground. And when it's safe to come back, we want you on the best part of your seat, the edge of it. So when it's your turn to get the vaccine, be a fan, take the shot.
Let's bring into our conversation Grammy Award-winning country music singer and songwriter, Brad Paisley. Thank you for joining us, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Nicole. It's good to see you.
What has this year been like for artists and performers and for you at the top of your industry? You're still without what I would imagine is your favorite thing to do, perform in front of living, breathing humans.
It's a really difficult time. I mean, we used to joke about no matter what happens in the recorded music industry, they can never take away the experience of live concerts from us. And last year changed that expression. So it's been a nightmare for anybody that makes their living with a group of people. And I think it's been an incredible thing to see us within this, what feels like a long time, but really it's a short amount of time, to have a light at the end of the tunnel. I'm very, very hopeful.
Yeah. And you're really partnering not just with the public relations campaign, but with the scientists. Talk about your investment in helping people trust the vaccine and trying to encourage them to view it as a way to get back to pre-COVID life.
Well, look, I have some really, really good friends that make their living and are experts in the field of medicine and science, and watching, like, seeing the data that they have sent me and realizing that we have really what's sort of a once in a 100 years opportunity to put something behind us that really could last a lot longer. I feel so, I feel very passionate about the chance that we have for normalcy again. In talking to them, it's been an amazing thing to watch this roll out and realize that we are headed in the right direction, but we've got to keep going. And anyway, I'm proud that Vanderbilt asked me to do this. I'm proud to stand up and say, listen, I feel very, very good about the opportunity we have medically to beat this thing.
So I know vaccine hesitant people in my life, and they're not this hardcore anti-vax zealots. They're just scared. And your message right. seems designed to sort of speak to the people that are scared, that group. I don't know if you know anyone in that group, but what is your message to them when you see them face to face?
It's an interesting thing because you're fighting against a lot of opposing voices on something like this, but this is the kind of thing where I am so willing to step out on this limb and say, I believe in this. I really do. I really believe that, you know, just knowing the doctors that I know, that I trust, about what the opportunity that we have. What I would say to people is you've got to sort of look at the worst case scenario. When, if we don't do this, if we don't band together and find a way to sort of convince enough of the population to step up, how long is this going to go on? How many people are going to die? And we've got to get mentally back to being to able to gather. I have an entire band and crew that are sitting around and have been waiting for this opportunity. And we have that. And we've got this destination of July 4th in mind, where we sort of celebrate as a city here in Nashville, the fact that, hey, we put this behind us, and I want us to be able to do that.
And how damaging to that effort is the current state of our politics on both sides?
Oh, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, but at the same time, I don't want to get weighed down worrying about that aspect of it. All I can do is use the voice that I have to sort of advocate for what I think is right. And it feels right to me. When I think about My parents, my mother is very high risk. My dad is in his 70s. The fact that they're fully vaccinated now, they were able to go out to dinner for the first time last month with some friends and sit outside. And they've been getting together with people that they haven't seen in a long time. Their lives are starting to feel normal again. And I think it's important for all of us to get back to where we're able to sort of look back on this at this time in our lives as a learning experience. And we have to have gotten past the politics of it to where we look back and did the right thing.
Well, I mean, to that end, your voice is a really important one. I'm sorry, my son walked in with a chicken while we were talking. I apologize for the background acoustics here. This is the joys of anchoring from the basement.
Right, Paisley.
Next time you're here, we'll tell everyone how we know each other. How's that for a tease?
Yeah, no, let's not do that because we would be embarrassed if they knew how we knew each other. So we'll just leave that as a mystery for the internet to solve.
Perfect. Your secret's safe with me. Brad will be headlining Nashville's July 4th celebration with the Nashville Symphony. Thank you for spending time with us today. We're really grateful.
It's great to see you. Thank you.
When we return, as we do every day, we will remember lives well lived. Generous and gentle, with an inquisitive, tinkering mind, that was Ike Kim. He moved to the States as a child after the Korean War. He went to college, got a degree in engineering, and started work at IBM, designing computer chips. He and his beloved wife went on to raise three wonderful sons. After Ike retired, his next adventure was a PhD in his own software company. In 2003, he suffered a heart attack that robbed him of much of his memory. But it left intact his unwavering instinct to provide for his family. They told us, quote, "Even without the means at his disposal, he never failed to ask when his grown children visited if there was anything they needed that he could provide." It's a trait that persevered right up until he contracted COVID-19 and died on New Year's Eve. We asked his daughter-in-law what we could learn from Ike's life. Her answer to us, quote, "Share how you feel. Don't wait to share your affection or your kind words. Do it now. Spread love around." Ike Kim is only 81 years old. We will be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.